Cassette 10, Side 2.
I still want to stay. What if Jillian's wrong? What if Takata Jim finishes converting the bombs early? Toshio shrugged. I still have something he needs. He glanced down at the second of two sleds in the pool, the one that had belonged to Tom Orley. Takata Jim won't take off without it. Exactly! Denny was emphatic. He'll need that radio, or the ETs would blast him to bits before he could negotiate. But you'll be all alone. That fin is dangerous. That's just one of many reasons I'm sending you away right now. Is this the big macho Mel talking? Denny tried sarcasm, but was unable to put much bite into it. No, Toshio shook his head. This is your military commander talking, and that's that. Now, let's get these last samples loaded. I'll escort you and Saud a few miles before we say goodbye. He bent over to pick up one of the parcels, but before he touched it, he felt a hand in the small of his back. A sharp push threw him off balance, flailing. Denny! He caught a glimpse of her, grinning devilishly. At the last moment, his left hand darted out and caught hers. Her laughter turned into a shriek as he dragged her after him into the water. They came up spluttering between the sleds. Denny cried out in triumph as she grabbed the top of his head with both hands and dunked him. Then she leapt half out of the water as something goosed her from behind. Toshio, she accused. That wasn't me. He caught his breath and backed out of arm's reach. It must have been your other lover. My... Oh, no! Saud! Denny whirled around, searching and kicking, then whooped as something got her from behind again. Do you scrotum brain males ever think of anything else? A mottled gray dolphin's head broached the surface nearby. The breather wrapped over his blowmouth only muted his chattering laughter slightly. Long before humans rode out on logs, we made an invention. Care to manage a try at menage a trois? He leered, and Toshio had to laugh as Denny blushed. That only sent her splashing water at him until he swam over and pinned her arms against one of the sleds. To stop her imprecations, he kissed her. Her lips bore the desperate tang of Kithrop as she kissed him back. Saut sidled up alongside them and nibbled their legs softly with jagged, sharp teeth. You know, we're not supposed to expose ourselves to this stuff if we can help it, Toshio told her as they held each other. You shouldn't have done that. Denny shook her head, then buried her face in his shoulder to hide it. Who are we fooling, Tosh? She mumbled. Why worry about slow metal poisoning? We'll be dead long before our gums start to turn blue. Aw, Denny, that's nuts. He sought words to comfort her, but found that all he could do was hold her close as the dolphin wrapped himself around them both. A few minutes later, a comm alert buzzed. Saud went over to the unit on Orley's sled, the one connected by monofilament cable to Streaker's old position. He listened to a brief burst of primitive clicks, then squawked quickly in reply. He rose high in the water, popping his breather loose.
It's for you, Toshio.
Toshio didn't bother asking if it was important. Over that line, it had to be. Gently, he disengaged from Denny. You finish packing. I'll be back right away to help. She nodded, rubbing her eyes. Stay with her a while, will you, Saud? He asked as he swam over to the comm unit. The steno shook his head.
I would gladly, Toshio. It's my turn to amuse the lady. Unfortunately, you need me here to translate.
Toshio looked at him uncomprehendingly.
It is the captain,
Saud informed him.
Crydike wants to talk to both of us. Then He wants us to help him get in touch with the techno inhabitants of this world.
Crydike? Calling here? But Jillian said he was missing.
Toshio's brow furrowed as the rest of Sout's sentence sunk in.
Techno? He wants to talk to the Kikwi?
Sout grinned.
No, sir. They hardly qualify, fearless military leader. Our captain wants to talk with my voices. He wants to talk to those who dwell below.
Chapter 82. Tom Orley. The brother of 12 Shadows piped softly. His pleasure spread through the waters around him, below the carpet of weeds. He swam away from the side of the ambush, the faint thrashing sounds of victims dying down behind him. The darkness beneath the weeds didn't bother him. Never would absence of light displease a brother of the night.
"Brother of the dim gloom," he hissed. "Do you rejoice as I do?"
From somewhere to his left, amongst the dangling sea vines, came a jubilant reply.
"I rejoice, senior brother. That group of Paha warriors shall never again kneel before perverted sorrow females, thank the ancient warlords."
"We shall thank them in person,"
Brother of 12 Shadows answered,
"when we learn the location of their returning fleet from the half-sentient earthers. For now, thank our long-deceased night-hunter patrons who made us such formidable fighters."
"I thank their spirits, senior brother."
They swam on, separated by the 70 body lengths demanded by underwater skirmish doctrine. The pattern was inconvenient with all these weeds about, and the water echoed strangely. But doctrine was doctrine, as unquestionable as instinct. Senior brother listened until the last weak struggles of the drowning Paha ceased. Now he and his fellow would swim toward one of the floating wrecks, where more victims surely awaited. It was like picking fruits from a tree. Even powerful warriors such as the Tandu were reduced to floundering dolts on this carpet of noxious weeds. But not the brothers of the night. Adaptable, mutable, they swam below, wreaking havoc where it could be wrought. His gill slits pulsed, sucking the metal tangy water through. The brother of 12 Shadows detected a patch of slightly higher oxygen content and took a slight detour to pass through it. Keeping to doctrine was important, surely, but here underwater, what could harm them? There was suddenly a flurry of crashing sounds to his left, a brief cry, and then silence.
"Lesser brother, what was that disturbance?"
he called in the direction his surviving partner had been. But speech carried poorly underwater. He waited with growing anxiety.
"Brother of the dim gloom?"
He dove beneath a cluster of hanging tendrils, holding a flechette gun in each of his 4 tool hands. What down here could have overcome so formidable a fighter as his lesser brother? Surely none of the patrons or clients he knew of could do such a thing. A robot should have caused his metal detectors to go off. It suddenly occurred to him that the half-sentient dolphins they sought might be dangerous in water. But no, dolphins were air breathers, and they were large. He swept the area around him and heard no likely reflections. The eldest brother, who commanded the remnants of their flotilla from a cave on a small moon, had concluded that the earthlings were not here in this northern sea, but he had sent a small vessel to harass and observe. The 2 brothers in the water were all that survived, but everything they had seen confirmed the quarry wasn't here. The brother of 12 Shadows quickly skirted the edge of an open pool. Had his younger brother strayed into the open and been blasted by a walker above? He swam toward a faint sound, weapons ready. In the darkness, he sensed a bulky body up ahead. He chirped out and concentrated on the complex echoes. The returning sounds showed only one large creature in the vicinity, still and silent. He swam forward, took hold of it, and mourned. Water pulsed through his gill slits, and he cried out, "I am going to avenge you, brother. I am going to slay all in this sea who think. I am going to bring darkness upon all who hope. I am going to—" There came a loud splash. He let out a brief irk as something heavy fell from above onto his right side and wrapped long legs and arms around him. As the brother of 12 shadows struggled, he realized in stupefaction that his enemy was a human, a half-sentient, frail-skinned, wolfling human. "Before you do all those other things, here's one thing you'll do first," the voice rasped in Galactic 10, just behind his hearing organs. The brother wailed. Something fiery, sharp, pierced his throat near the dorsal nerve cord. He heard his enemy say, almost sympathetically, "You are going to die." Chapter 83. Jillian.
"All I can tell you, Jillian Baskin, is that he knew how to find me. He came here aboard a walker and spoke to me from the hallway."
"Krydike was here?"
"Tom and I figured he'd deduced we had a private, high-level computer, but the location should have been impossible."
"I was not terribly surprised, Dr. Baskin," the NIST machine interrupted, covering the impoliteness with a soothing pattern of abstract images. "The captain clearly knows his ship. I had expected him to guess my location."
Jillian sat by the door and shook her head.
"I should have come when you first signaled for me. I might have been able to stop him from leaving."
"It is not your fault," the machine answered with uncharacteristic sensitivity. "I would have made the request more demanding if I thought the situation urgent."
"Oh, sure," Jillian was sarcastic. "It's not urgent when a valuable fleet officer succumbs to pressure atavism and gets lost in a deadly alien wilderness."
The patterns danced.
"You are mistaken. Captain Krydike has not fallen prey to reversion schizophrenia."
"How would you know?"
Jillian said hotly.
"Over a third of the crew of this vessel have shown signs since the ambush at Morgren, including all but a few of the Stenos grafted Fen. How can you say Krydike hasn't reverted after all he's suffered? How can he practice Kanink when he can't even talk?"
The Nis answered calmly.
"He came here seeking specific information. He knew I had access not only to Streaker's micro-branch library, but the more complete one taken from the Thenanin wreck. He could not tell me what it was he wanted to know, but we found a way to get across the speech barrier."
"How?"
Jillian was fascinated in spite of her anger and guilt.
"By pictograms, visual and sound pictures of alternate choices, which I presented to him quite rapidly. He made quick yes or no sounds to tell when I was getting, as you humans say, hotter or colder. Before long, he was leading me, making associations I had not even begun to consider."
"Like what?"
The light motes sparkled.
"Like the way many of the mysteries regarding this unique world seem to come together. The strangely long time this planet has lain fallow since its last tenants became degenerate and settled here to die. The unnatural ecological niche of the so-called drill tree mounds. Souts, strange voices from the depths. Dolphins of Sout's temperament are always hearing voices, Jillian sighed. And don't forget, he's another of those experimental Stenos. I'm sure some of them were passed into this crew without the normal stress tests.
After a short pause, the machine answered matter-of-factly.
There is evidence, Dr. Baskin. Apparently Dr. Ignacio Metz is a representative of an impatient faction at the Center for Uplift.
Jillian stood up.
Uplift! Damn it, I know what Metz did. You think I'm blind? I've lost several dear friends and irreplaceable crewmates because of his crazy scheme. Oh, he hot-tested his sports all right, and some of the new models failed under pressure. But all that's finished. What does Uplift have to do with voices from below, or drill tree mounds, or the history of Kithrop, or our friendly cadaver Herbie, for that matter? What does any of it have to do with rescuing our lost people and getting away from here?
Her heart raced, and Jillian found that her fists were clenched.
Dr. Baskin,
the Nis replied smoothly,
that was exactly what I asked your Captain Krydike. When he put the pieces together for me, I too realized that Uplift is not an irrelevant question here. It is the only question. Here at Kithrop, all that is good and evil about this several billion-year-old system is represented. It is almost as if the very basis of galactic society has been placed on trial.
Jillian blinked at the abstract images.
How ironic, the disembodied voice went on, that the question rests with you humans, the first sophant race in eons to claim evolved intelligence. Your discovery in the so-called Shallow Cluster may result in a war that fills the five galaxies, or it may fade away like so many other chimerical crises. But what is done here on Kithrop will become a legend. All of the elements are there. And legends have a tendency to affect events long after wars are forgotten.
Jillian stared at the hologram for a long moment. Then she shook her head.
Will you please tell me what the bloody damn hell you are talking about?
Chapter 84
Hikahi, Kipiru.
We must hurry, the pilot insisted.
Kipiru lay strapped to a portadock. Catheters and tubes ran from the webbing that kept him suspended above the water's surface. The sound of the skiff's engines filled the tiny chamber.
You must relax, Hikahi soothed. The autopilot is in charge now. We're going as fast as we can underwater. We should be there very soon.
Hikahi was still somewhat numbed by the news about Krydike, and shaken by Takata Jim's treachery. But over it all, she could not bring herself to accept Kipiru's frantic urgency. He was obviously driven by his devotion to Jillian Baskin, and wanted to return to her aid instantly, if possible. Hikahi looked at things from another perspective. She knew Jillian probably already had things well under control back at the ship. Compared with the disaster she had been fantasizing the last few days, the news seemed almost buoyant. Even Krydike's injury could not suppress Hikahi's relief that Streaker survived intact. Her harness whined. With one Waldo hand, she touched a control to give Kipiru a mild soporific.
Now I want you to sleep, she told him. You must regain your strength. Consider that an order if, as you say, I am now acting captain.
Kipiru's eyes began to recess. The lids drooped together slowly.
I'm sorry, sir. I guess I'm not much more logical than Moki. I'm always causing trouble.
His speech slurred as the drug took hold. Ikahi swam almost underneath the drowsy pilot and sighed a brief, soft lullaby. Dream defender, dream of those who love you and bless your courage. Chapter 85. Jillian.
You're saying these Krank were the last Sophants to have license to the planet Kithrop 100 million years ago?
Correct, the Nis machine replied. They were savagely abused by their patrons, mutated far beyond the degree allowed by the codes. According to the Thenanin battleship's library, it caused quite a scandal at the time. In compensation, the Krank were released from their indenture as clients and granted a world suited to their needs, one with low potential for developing pre-sentience. Water worlds make good retirement homes for that reason. Few pre-Sophants ever arise on such planets. The Kikwi seem to be an exception. Jillian paced the sloping ceiling of the lopsided room. An occasional clanking, transmitted by the metal walls, told of the final fittings being made to secure Streaker into the Trojan Seahorse.
You aren't saying the Kikwi have anything to do with these ancient...
No, they appear to be a genuine find, and a major reason why you should endeavor to escape this trap and return to Earth with what you have learned.
Jillian smiled ironically.
Thanks, we'll do our best. So, what was done to the Krank?
She did her best with the double glottal stop.
To make them want to hide away on Kithrop, never to associate with galactic culture again.
The Nis explained.
In their pre-sentient form, they were mole-like creatures on a metal-rich world like this one. They had carbon-oxygen metabolisms, such as yours, but they were excellent diggers.
Let me guess. They were bred as miners to extract ores on metal-poor worlds.
It would be cheaper to import and breed Krank diggers than ship large quantities of metals across interstellar space. A very good guess, Dr. Baskin. The client Krank were indeed transformed into miners, and in the process converted to a metabolism extracting energy directly from radioactives. Their patrons thought it would help serve as an incentive.
Jillian whistled.
Such a drastic shift in their structure couldn't have been successful. Ifni, they must have suffered.
It was a perversion, the Nis agreed. When it was discovered, the Krank were freed and offered recompense. But after a few millennia trying to adapt to standard starfaring life, they chose to retire to Kithrop. This planet was ceded them for the duration of their race. No one expected them to survive for long. Instead of dying out, however, they seem to have continued to modify themselves on their own. They appear to have adopted a lifestyle unique in known space.
Jillian brought together the threads of the earlier part of the conversation and made an inference. Her eyes widened.
You mean to tell me the metal mounds are larvae of an intelligent life form which dwells in the crust of this planet?
Yes. I might have surmised this from the latest data sent by Dr. Denny Sudman, but Krydike had leapt to the conclusion before we even heard from her. That is why he came to see me,
to get confirmation of his hypothesis.
Sounds, voices,
Jillian whispered.
They're Kerrang!
An acceptable tentative deduction,
the Nis approved.
It would have been the discovery of the century, were it not for the other things you've already turned up on this expedition. I believe you humans have an old expression in English. It doesn't rain, but it pours. It's quaint, but apropos.
Jillian wasn't listening.
The bombs!
She slapped her forehead.
I beg your pardon?
I let Charlie Dart steal some low-yield bombs from our armory. I knew Takata Jim would confiscate them and begin transforming them into fuel. It was part of a plan I had cooked up, but...
You assumed Takata Jim would confiscate all of the bombs?
Yes. I was going to call him up and tip him off if he overlooked them, but he was quite efficient and discovered them right away. I had to lie to Toshio about it, but that couldn't be helped.
If all went according to plan, I do not see the problem.
The problem is that Takata Jim may not have seized all of the bombs. It never occurred to me that Charlie could harm living Sofans if he still had one. Now, though, I've got to get in touch with Toshio at once.
Can it wait a few minutes? Takata Jim probably was thorough, and there is another matter I wish to discuss with you.
No, you don't understand. Toshio's about to sabotage his comm set. It's part of my plan. If there's even a chance Charlie's got a bomb, we have to find out quickly.
The holo patterns were agitated.
I'll make the connection at once, the Nis announced. It will take me a few moments to worm through Streaker's comm system without being detected. Stand by.
Jillian paced the sloping floor, hoping they would be in time. Chapter 86 Toshio. Toshio finished the rewiring, slapped the cover over the transmitter on Thomas Orley's sled, and spread a light smear of mud on the plate to make it seem long unopened. Then he unhitched the monofilament line from the unit, tied a small red marker ribbon to the end, and let the almost invisible fiber drift down into the depths. Now he was out of touch with Streaker. It made him feel more alone than ever, even lonelier than when Denny and Saud had departed early in the morning. He hoped Takata Jim would follow orders and wait here until Streaker left. If he did, Jillian would call down as they blasted away and warn him of the modifications that had been made to the longboat and this transmitter. But what if Takata Jim were indeed a traitor? What if he took off early? Charles Dart would probably be aboard then, as well as Ignacio Metz, 3 Stenos, and perhaps 3 or 4 Kikwi. Toshio wished none of them harm. It was an agonizing choice. He looked up and saw Charles Dart happily muttering to himself as he played with his new robot. Toshio shook his head, glad that the chimp at least was happy. He slid into the water and swam over to his own sled. He had jettisoned its tiny radio an hour ago. He strapped himself in and turned on the motors. He still had to make one more splice below the island. The old robot, the damaged probe Charles Dart had abandoned down near the bottom of the drill tree shaft, had one last customer. Krydike, hanging around Streaker's old site, still wanted to talk to Sout's voices. Toshio figured he owed the captain the favor, even if he did feel like he was humoring a delusion. As the sled sank, Toshio thought about the rest of his job here, the things he might have to do before he could leave. "Let Tom Orley be waiting for me when I come back up," he wished fervently. That would solve everything. Let Mr. Orley be finished with his job up in the north and land up there while I'm below. Toshio smiled ironically. And while you're at it, Ifni, why not throw in a giant fleet of good guys to clear the skies of baddies, hmm? He descended down the narrow shaft into the gloom. Chapter 87 Jillian.
Drat! Triple hell! The line's dead. Toshio's already cut it.
Don't be overly alarmed, the Nis spoke reassuringly. It is quite likely that Takata Jim confiscated all of the bombs. Did not Midshipman Iwashika report that he saw several being dismantled for fuel, as you expected?
Yes, and I told him not to worry about it, but it never occurred to me to ask him to count them. I was caught up in the minutiae of moving the ship, and I didn't think Charlie would do any real harm, even if by some chance he managed to keep one.
Now, of course, we know better.
Jillian looked up, wondering if the Timbrimey machine was being tactful or obliquely sarcastic.
Well, she said, what's done is done. Whatever happens can't affect us here. I just hope we don't add a crime against a sentient race to our dubious record on this voyage. She sighed.
Now, will you tell me again how all this is going to become some sort of legend?
Chapter 88 Toshio. The connection was made. Now Kraidaiki could listen to the underground sounds to his heart's content. Toshio let the monofilament drop into the mud. He emptied ballast, and the sled rose in a spiral toward the drill tree shaft. When he surfaced, Toshio knew at once that something had changed. The second sled, the one belonging to Tom Orley, had been dragged up the steep embankment and lay on the sward to the south of the pool. Wires dangled from an open section in the control panel. Charles Dart squatted by the water's edge. The chimp leaned forward with his finger to his lips. Toshio cut the motors and loosened his straps. He sat up and looked about the clearing, but saw only the waving forest fronds. Charlie said in a guttural whisper,
I think Takata Jim and Metz are planning to take off soon, Toshio, with or without me.
Dart looked confused, as if dazed by the foolishness of the idea. Toshio kept his expression guarded.
What makes you think that, Dr. Dart?
As soon as you went down, two of Takata Jim's Stenos came to take that sled's radio. Also, when you were below, they tested the engines. They sounded kind of ragged at first, but they're working on 'em now. I think now they don't even care if you report back anymore.
Toshio heard a soft growling sound to the south, a low whine that rose and fell unevenly. A rustle of movement to the north caught his eye. He saw Ignacio Metz hurrying southward down the forest trail, carrying bundles of records. Behind him trooped four sturdy Kikwi volunteers from the village. Their air sacs were puffed up proudly, but they obviously did not like approaching the rough engine noises. They carried crude bundles in front of them. From the foliage, several dozen pairs of wide eyes watched the procession nervously. Toshio listened to the sound of the engines and wondered how much time was left. Takata Jim had finished recycling the bombs sooner than expected. Perhaps they had underestimated the Dolphin Lieutenant. How much else had he jury-rigged to make the longboat serviceable ahead of schedule? Should I try to delay their takeoff? If I stay any longer, it's unlikely I'd ever reach Streaker in time.
What about you, Dr. Dart? Are you ready to finish up and hop aboard when Takata Jim calls?
Dart glanced to his console. He shook his head.
I need another 6 hours, he grumbled. Maybe we've got a common interest in delaying the longboat taking off. You got any ideas?
Toshio considered. Well, this is it, isn't it? This is where you decide. Leave now if you plan to go at all. Toshio exhaled deeply. Ah, well.
If I think of a way to delay them for a while, Dr. Dart, will you help me? It may be a little risky.
Dart shrugged.
All I'm doing right now is waiting for my bot to dig into the crust to bury an instrument. I'm free until then. What do I have to do?
Toshio unhooked the monofilament feeder coil from his sled and cut the free end.
Well, for starters, I think we'll need someone to climb some trees.
Charlie grimaced.
Stereotypes,
he muttered to himself.
All the time getting trapped by stereotypes.
This ends side 2 of cassette 10.